The final section of the Catechism is, well, obviously you can see I've just raced through a whole lot of headings for you. But now we'll slow down. It's the last section is called Love for the Poor. And I hope you find some of this a bit inspiring and helpful. The Hebrew Scriptures, let's start there. We've already heard Amos and Isaiah in the first half of today. Worshipping Yahweh as the Redeemer God, the God who brought people out of slavery, we're not surprised to find this topic central to the Torah and the prophets. You were once slaves in Egypt, so don't treat slaves badly. You couldn't have Hebrew slaves. You could have foreign slaves. They didn't think about that. But so there's a lot of wonderful stuff in the Jewish scriptures about this care for the poor, because God is the one who hears the cry of the poor. And that makes what's happening in Israel now doubly painful, doesn't it? And I imagine if I was a Jew not living in Israel, or the many thousands of Jews that are living in Israel that don't like what their government is doing, must be a very painful situation to see your religion abused in this dreadful way that it's happening there. And then America saying don't do it and then funding it. So the following statements are typical. Exodus 22:23. If you do abuse them, the poor, when they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry. The prophet Malachi, one of the last of the prophets, post-exilic prophets. I will draw near to you for judgment. I will be swift to bear witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, against those who swear falsely, against those who oppress the hired workers in their wages, the widow and the orphan, against those who thrust aside the alien. The asylum seeker. And do not fear me, says the Lord of hosts. The New Testament. Luke, Jesus speaking. Luke chapter 3 verse 11. I'm sorry, this is actually John the Baptist speaking. Whoever has two coats must share with anyone who has none. Whoever has food must do likewise. And now Jesus to the Pharisees. Give for alms those things that are within, and everything will be clean. He talks about them being hypocrites, cleaning the outside, but not, it's not coming from the heart, and they're not pure in heart, so the gifts are not really coming from them, and you'll be clean if you give alms from the things that are within. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust consume, where thieves break in and steal. The prophet James is wonderful on this. And James is the most Jewish of the letters. If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and eat your fill, but you don't supply their bodily needs, what's the good of that? Again, James chapter 5, quoted in the Catechism number 2445. Come now, you rich people, weep and wail for the miseries that are coming to you. Your riches have rotted, your clothes are moth-eaten, your gold and silver have rusted. Their rust will be evidence against you, and it will eat your flesh like fire. You've laid up treasures for the last days. Listen, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You've lived on the earth in luxury and in pleasure. You've fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You've condemned and murdered the righteous one. Does not God oppose you? And Paul, writing to his young co-worker Timothy, writes, those who want to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. I found some homilies in the writings of the early church that seem pretty modern to me, so I'll read them out to you and see if you like them. The first is from the letter of Barnabas, it's from the 2nd century. It reads, the fast of my choice is this. It's a Lenten homily. Relax all your iniquitous restrictions. Loosen the shackles of your oppressive covenants. Let your ruined debtors go free and tear up all your unjust agreements. We just had some of them torn up recently in Parliament, thank God. Break up your bread into portions for the starving, and if you see a man who is in want of clothing, fit him out yourself. Bring in the homeless under your own roof. I did that while presbyteries aren't that good for this, but I did it once about 2 or 3 years ago. We arrived home in the car, Jim and I think, and there was a chap there lurking around, a young fella, and he'd been kicked out of home and had nowhere to stay, so I thought, oh, I'll come in. So I came in, made his bed for him, gave him a towel and settled him down. And next morning he'd been through the rooms and robbed whatever he could find. Luckily I didn't have anything in the room, but Mark lost a bit and Jim lost whatever he had in the room. So I met him the next morning too and showed him out and said, do you want breakfast? Oh, no, he said. So it's a risky business, isn't it, really? But, yeah, there we are. So bring in the homeless under your own roof. You are not to withdraw into yourselves and live in solitude as though God had already pronounced you holy. Come, take your full share in the meetings. That's the church meeting, Sunday. And in deliberating for the common good. Our parish, maybe all parishes, we tithe, so we make sure that a tenth of the money that comes in doesn't stay in the parish but goes out to various needs. And the finance committee keep insisting on it, and we keep making sure we do it. You know, it'd be nice to pay off the church debt, be more quick if we didn't do that, but the community want it, so it's our little systemic attempt to do something and not just look after ourselves here. Yeah. Here's St. Basil. See if you like this. 379 he died, so late in the 4th century. When someone steals another person's clothes, we call that person a thief. Should we not give the same name to one who could clothe the naked and doesn't? The bread in your cupboard belongs to the person who's hungry. The coat hanging, oh God, am I blushing? The coat hanging, don't laugh, it's serious, unused in your wardrobe belongs to the person who needs it. The shoes rotting there belong to the one who has no shoes. The money you're hoarding belongs to the poor. When I read that, I just overwhelm with gratitude for the Vincent de Paul Society. It is one of the greatest gifts the Catholic Church has. And invariably, they're simple men and women, no airs, no publicity, no nothing, and there they are doing this week in and week out and knocking on doors, and I think, God, or canonise a lot of them and then get on, you know, because they're doing all this. Thank God they are. Here's Gregory the Great. When we attend to the needs of those in want, we give them what is theirs, not ours. More than performing works of mercy, We're paying a debt of justice. Here's St. John Chrysostom, who died at the beginning of the 5th century. And he's got a homily on Lazarus. It's actually quoted in the Catechism. Not to enable the poor to share in our goods is to steal from them and deprive them of life. The goods we possess are not ours, but theirs. That really shifts, doesn't it? It shifts your idea of the seventh commandment, shifts my idea in here radically and brings a bit of perturbation in, which is, I think, appropriate. Here's a sermon that John Chrysostom wrote on the letter of Timothy, and it goes for a page and a half, so enjoy it. Tell me, he says, how did you come by your wealth? And poor old Chrysostom, by the way, he's a monk, and they dragged him in to be the Patriarch of Constantinople. And they stuck a big on his head, and the emperor was there, of course, and all the highfalutin people, and he was just a straight, honest, holy monk. Eventually he said, you can keep your patriarchate, and he went off to, he just couldn't, like, it just didn't fit him, and good on him, that's all right. So he gave it away and went to the Black Sea somewhere and continued on with his life. You don't have to do what you're not gifted for, do you, even if other people want you to do it? Tell me, how did you come by your wealth? Did you receive it from someone? Where did he get it? From his grandfather? Father? Are you able to show, as you go back through the generations, that it was justly acquired? It can't have been, he says. No, the beginning and root of wealth must lie in injustice of some sort. I'm enjoying watching all your faces. I hope you're enjoying watching mine. Why, he says. You may not agree with John Chrysostom. It doesn't mean he's right. I'm just giving it to you because he said it. Why? Because in the beginning, God didn't create one person wealthy and another to go wanting. He gave one and the same earth to all alike. And inasmuch as the earth is a common possession, how is it that you have acres and acres of land while your neighbour hasn't the tiniest fraction of the earth?
They probably didn't work.
Good on you, Eileen. That's good. You're giving the cause for the devil's advocate. So he continues. Even if your wealth has been gathered honestly, even if, is wealth something good? Not at all, he says. Nor is it something evil, so long as it's not hoarded and is shared out with those in need. You must know people. Often it goes with being in the country. I think city life's harder. I remember reading that once, I think it's psychologically a pretty sound principle. When you've got space around you, you know, you're not kind of like this, you reach out to neighbours and they reach out to you because you do have a little bit of space you can go back to. But in a city, we're not really adapted to cities so much because we're all crowded in, and so if you open your door to everyone else in the flat, well, you'll be totally oppressed. And I can remember when I came out of the seminary with all these ideas, walking down Pitt Street. And I think when I started in Sydney, I was saying hello to the people walking by. Well, that lasted about 2 seconds, because how do you? So you have to almost treat people as impersonal, almost. I remember talking in the bus to someone and then finding I was the only one talking. I thought you always talk to the person sitting next to you. But I don't now, because I've been socialised out of it, you know. In simple, poor people seem to be the most generous people. They seem to be the ones most, everything's open and giving and sharing, and I've experienced that in a number of places. So here we are, anyhow. How do you live in a city is a good question. Unshared, wealth becomes something evil. It becomes a trap, says John Chrysostom. Is it not evil that you claim sole ownership of what belongs to the Lord, of what is common property? The Aborigines had big trouble with this. We've just come to realise, haven't we? Like initially, if they saw sheep and if, that someone would own a sheep is just not, they can't think of it because no one owns a kangaroo, like, or a lizard, or so just a sheep. So they spear it for food because that's what you do with animals. And then suddenly these people come out with big guns and start shooting them because they're robbing their private possessions. Well, mentally, just wasn't the clash of cultures. How do you understand? So he's, do you deny that the Lord's is the earth and its fullness? Whatever belongs to the Lord belongs equally to all. Strife comes only when someone tries to gain possession of something and make it his own. It is as if human nature itself grows angry when, in spite of God's uniting us in every way, we're bent on dividing and standing apart by owning things and using phrases like, this belongs to me, or that is yours. When do kids start doing that? When they're about two, is it? Or six? Something like about two, okay. Well, we should have grown up, but we've actually continued along that little. So, this belongs to me, or that's yours. Chilling words indeed. Whatever is necessary for life is given to all alike, says John Chrysostom. Yet even in the smallest matters, we can't seem to keep things common to all. God has made his great gifts available to all in common so that we might learn to share lesser things. But we've not learnt this lesson. He's writing in 400 AD. So, how then can a rich person be good? And he gives an answer, by giving his wealth to others and so by being no longer wealthy. As long as he hoards it for himself, he cannot be good. That's John Chrysostom writing in another culture at another time, so we have to work it out. But at least the principles there, it doesn't hurt if they stir us a bit, does it, and make us a bit insecure about how we're living. And we had it the other day, didn't we, that in the early church people lived in common and shared everything. And it's kind of like a beautiful ideal, and how do you do it and all that. But to not ask the question wouldn't be good. And I conclude now with someone got at this or something. I've got the wrong page again, so I'll just read for you. The last section is on the preferential option for the poor. Albert Nolan, a Dominican, writing in South Africa, and he's just written another book, which we're using in our parish pastoral council now, and I can't think of the name of it. Jesus, that's it, thank you. Jesus Today. And he'd written a couple of little things in between, but this has got to be 30 years ago when he wrote this one, called Jesus Before Christianity, thank you. In that he writes, the option for the poor is an uncompromising and unequivocal taking of sides in a situation of structural conflict. It's not a matter of preaching to some people rather than to others, or a matter of being generous to the underprivileged, or a judgment about the personal guilt of the rich, or even, in the first instance, a matter of lifestyle. Option for the poor is the assertion that Christian faith entails, for everyone and as part of its essence, the taking of sides in the structural conflict between the oppressor and the oppressed. It's only after one has learnt to have confidence in the ability of the oppressed to promote their own cause and to bring about their own liberation that one can begin to share that struggle with them and to make a contribution in real solidarity with all those who've taken an option against oppression. I think it's quite a brilliant, it's in the hard copy on the web, definition of this preferential option for the poor, which the church has embraced in its documents. But that's the best definition I've ever found. And if I may, just on a very personal note, in my youth, I don't know, I was 35 or something, I was chaplain at the university from 35 to 40, more than that, 8 years in my 30s. At the University of New South Wales. And that was during the Vietnam War period and all that kind of thing. And a lot of issues, thank God, came up at the university. A lot of issues. I hope they still do. But it got less and less during the 70s because the people running the university had worked out how to divide and conquer. So they had classes all through lunchtime, classes after. You could never get the students together on the campus. And that was surely a technique to make sure you didn't have these wild university students thinking or objecting against anything. So in any case, just my own personal experience was every issue that came up, and I can't remember many of them now, there always conflict. There's always, if you go with this group, you find yourself with every bullfed in the world that you don't agree with. And of course they find themselves with you as a bullfed whom they don't agree with too. Like you don't get a pure group agreeing. So anti-Vietnam wasn't that difficult to agree on, but there were a lot of issues, and I learned, I hope it was right, I did learn that, no, you've just got to take the side of the oppressed and go with it. And you'll find if you take the side of the oppressed, you're with a lot of people who think, oh, the chaplain's here with us, he might agree with us. And you don't agree with them on 9 out of 10 issues, but you do on the 10th, and that's what you demonstrating about. Do you get what I kind of mean? I was kind of a bit wanting to be pure and right and safe and correct, and which would have meant I would have done nothing except sit in my office and give advice. You know, what's the point of that? But I did find that I was with all, and I think well, for me it was a good discovery to do that, to actually take an issue, take the side of the oppressed, and whoever you're with, that's where you should be, and be there. Otherwise, you're part of the problem, not part of the solution, part of the oppressor, by your silence or by your conniving or whatever. Here's better, let's listen to John Paul II. In his Sollicitudo Rei Socialis, 1987, another wonderful document on this whole issue of justice. One of the characteristic themes and guidelines dealt with by the Magisterium in recent years is the option or love of preference for the poor. This is an option or a special form of primacy in the exercise of Christian charity to which the whole tradition of the Church bears witness. And I've given you a bit of that in the Scriptures and a bit in the early sermons of the Fathers of the Church. It cannot but embrace the immense multitudes of the hungry, the needy, the homeless, those without medical care, and above all those without hope of a better future. It's impossible not to take account of the existence of these realities. To ignore them would mean becoming like the rich man who pretended not to know the beggar Lazarus lying at his gate. That's a very powerful parable, isn't it? Because the rich man and Lazarus, I know you know the story, what fascinates me about it is the rich man didn't do anything wrong to the poor, to Lazarus. He didn't do anything to him at all. He just didn't know him and didn't care to help him. It was the failure to do something that Jesus speaks out against very strongly. He wasn't the oppressor, but he was the one who didn't care for the oppressed. And the Pope brings it up there. Now, in Laborum Exercens, another of the encyclicals, I've given you about 4 or 5 there in the list, new movements of solidarity of the workers and with the workers must be present whenever it's called for by the social degrading of the subjects of work. This is on unionism. And my father, anyhow, and my grandfather, my history in Australia, I'm proud of it. They worked really hard to get justice in our country. And a lot of people have learnt how to work hard to stop the means of justice being effective. and abused. They've been abusers, I know that, but here's the Pope coming out very strongly in favour of workers being able to collaborate, because they can't argue on their own individually against the person with the money and the power and the law. So new movements of solidarity of the workers and with the workers must be present whenever it's called for by the social degrading of the subjects of work, by exploitation of the workers, and by growing areas of poverty and even hunger. The Church is firmly committed to the cause of the poor, for it considers it to be its mission, its service, a proof of its fidelity to Christ, so that it can truly be the Church of the poor. Again, Pope John Paul II, and this is from his Centesimus Annus, 1991. The preferential option for the poor is not limited to material poverty, since it is well known that there are many other forms of poverty, especially in modern society, not only economic, but cultural and spiritual poverty as well. And he continues in number 58, promoting justice is a matter of helping entire peoples which are at present excluded or marginalised to enter into the sphere of economic and human development. For this to happen, it's not enough to draw on the surplus goods which in fact our world abundantly produces. It requires, above all, a change of lifestyle. Models of production and consumption and of the established structures of power which today govern societies. And I conclude this and to conclude my lecture with just a comment here. May make sense, it may not. I'm no expert in this field, of course. There are many indices of poverty. Some people are poor from only one point of view. Others are poor from many points of view. However, the greatest poverty is to be deprived of love and not to recognize this is to run the risk of distorting the gospel and of undervaluing what people are already doing in the cause of justice, and so of adding to the oppression that saps people's energy. The implications of this are that a preferential option for the poor can take place in any genuine human interaction anywhere. It's a matter of one's entry point into that interaction and the dynamic that takes place there and of the direction which the energy of the interaction takes. Why did I write that? I guess because I believe it, but also it seems to me, since I can be overwhelmed by the immense problems of the world in this area, I imagine you can be too, I imagine we all can be, and there can't be much value in my or your being overwhelmed by it. I mean, if there's things we can do, we do. But to be overwhelmed by the size of it and reduced to fear we can do nothing would be dreadful. But because of the power of the news media and because of every bit of poverty in the world hits us every day if we watch, we can get overwhelmed by it. So I've said that, I hope that's in a consistent with the gospel, is no, I think the greatest poverty people have, there's poverty everywhere, dreadful types of poverty, but to be deprived of love is really, I think it's the worst. So none of us are incapable of reaching out in love to another. That's what we talked about this morning about a homosexual person, for example. But in every field at all, we've got something in us that we can give, and people do. And it would be sad if they didn't realise that that's helping the poor, that loving, that listening. And sometimes it will lead to people doing wonderful things. A friend of mine, she talked about this doctor, in fact, in Ireland, in Ireland, and he was a doctor, and he saw, and he got caught up in, where does Ceausescu, Romania, wasn't it? And the dreadful orphanages that we saw a little bit of some 5 or 6 or 10 years ago, I've just lost it a bit track. Because of that, he then, in his retirement he spent years and years and years collecting medicine, going over there, helping those, and I think, gee, that's beautiful. So it took him, because of his skill, it took him somewhere, and that's where it took him. Now, where's it going to take me? Where's it going to take you? Where's it going to take us? But I suspect, I hope it's true, that if it's going to take me, because I'll talk about myself, if I'm going to be fair dinkum about this, and it's so big, I think the only thing I can do is try and listen and try and love where I am and see where it takes me. And as a priest, you've got limitations, and as a religious you have, and as a male you have, and all that. So it seems to me, anyhow, that's how I try and handle. I think, well, I'll try and be open, and it may not take me anywhere. Maybe my job will be to be a priest at Kippax for whatever many years and to try and love people, and then they'll do it and I won't do it. But so I'm talking about me, but I'm not. Do you know what I mean? I'm talking about you and everybody. We've got to get our starting point is the key. And if the starting point is a respect of other people, not pretending we know them, not coming down hard on anybody, what's the point of that, for heaven's sake? Sharing our values with a question mark after them all the time, I think, because values that I explicitly share are not going to be perfect, are they? They're going to be limited by my experience and so on. Do all that, but do it lovingly, do it humbly, do it really, and try and I think that will take us all along a road which will lead somewhere beautiful, and we'll all go in different directions with that, but at least we're starting from the belief that God is love, that God is inspiring each one of us to love other people, and that as we read too, and I would recommend those encyclicals of John Paul II particularly, he's got about 5 or 6 of them on this matter of justice, and they're all referred to here, of course. Getting our mind in with the church's understanding, because a lot of this isn't preached that much, I think. You know, I don't know what we do, what I do, you tend to because you can't do it in a 10-minute homily. You know, you need to do it in a more serious way and more intellectual way. And by the way, while I'm saying that, the latest copy of Compass, you might know Compass. Compass is the theological magazine that the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart, of which I'm a member, get out about 4 times, or in fact it's 4 times a year, once every season. The autumn one for this year has just come out. We just received it at the church, and there's a very good article in it, very good article, by a Redemptorist, Tony Kelly, CSSR, thank you. Good. Very good article on the Catholic intellectual tradition. And it's about hope and about how important it is that the Catholic tradition, he's not excluding others, but he's talking about, which is a wonderful tradition of intellectual thinking and searching for the truth. Well, you know that, but it's quite wonderful. But it's a bit thin today, I think. It's a bit not, how many of us are actually getting into it? And school's hard to do it, and the adult attention has been reduced enormously by the 2-second ads. You know what I mean? We're all a bit, if you talk to people for more than 2 minutes, they look a bit glazed. No, not quite, but you know, there's how many of us actually spend time in intellectual pursuits trying to get to the end of big questions and doing it together too? So anyhow, I recommend that for your reading. It's on the web, by the way, but I can't give you the web page because it's that big. I didn't bring it with me. So we're moving today into the 7th commandment. One particular large area of it I've put off till next week, but I'll otherwise it's to me a very straightforward lecture. So the Catechism covers 6 sections, and the numbers are there should you want to look. Universal destination and private ownership of goods, it looks into that. Very important basic principle of Catholic doctrine. It talks about respect for persons and their goods. It talks about the social doctrine of the Church, which is massive, really, and very informed, and wonderful stuff. Got a book here I'll be recommending to you. This is a compendium of the social doctrine of the Church, and it's a compendium of 426 pages. There's a massive amount around and thinking, and in fact the next encyclical of the present Pope is going to be on the social area, I understand. It should come out fairly soon. So the Church has had an obvious commitment to this, trying to get it right, and it's constantly changing, so that the people's rights are respected, and there's this gap between the rich and the poor is lessened, and all the rest of it, justice and so on. Fourth section, economic activity and social justice, justice and solidarity among nations, and then finally love for the poor. So they're the sections. Now I'm going to take you through some of them. These all are built up on a very straightforward little sentence in Exodus chapter 20, verse 15, and Deuteronomy 5:19 in the Ten Commandments, and it's made up of these: you shall not steal. How could we get two-hour lectures out of that? Isn't that amazing? Or a book that big. Okay. This is quoted by Jesus to the rich young man. He tells him the commandment. He said, I've done that ever since I was young. And Jesus says, well, look, there's something more if you want. You could come and follow me. You could enter into a whole new world of loving and so on. This commandment was certainly, oh, this is where I want to start, this commandment was certainly not understood as protecting possessions unjustly acquired, or luxuries held in the face of deprivation and poverty. The prophets again and again accuse the rich of stealing from the poor. So let's stay with that one, because it's more likely to be relating to me and you. I don't know where you are on the economic scale, but I'm in a pretty good place, I think. I don't have any money of my own, but I've got everything I want. And the plate, you can always fiddle with the plate a bit and get a bit more. No, so it's, I've never been deprived, put it that way. Mind you, I don't want anything either, so it helps. Right, listen to this now. Amos, the earliest of the prophets whose words we have in writing. So we're going back to the 740 BC. Chapter 4. Hear this word, you cows of Bashan. Bashan is in the high country, the Golan Heights area, and the cows up there were well fed and stocky, and so he's talking about the rich who are. Hear this, you cows of Bashan, who are on Mount Samaria. This is the Samaria, the town, the city built, the biggest city in Palestine at this time, who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, who say to your husbands, bring something to drink. The Lord Yahweh has sworn by his holiness, the time is surely coming among you when they'll take you away with hooks, even the last of you with fish hooks. Through breaches in the wall you shall leave, says Yahweh. Now, I don't know what Yahweh was actually saying and what language he spoke, but you can see the passion of the prophet, who was a country boy, came into the big city, which had just been built, and had plenty of luxury, and saw the dreadful way the poor were being treated by the rich, and he calls them, they're all images for that. And he was only 5 or 6 years short of the destruction of Samaria, and they were carted off into exile, and that was the end of the northern kingdom. So there's obviously, all he needed was to keep his eyes open to realise what was going to happen if they continued with this dreadful injustice. Amos continues, hope you like it. Alas for those who are at ease in Zion. Now we're into Jerusalem, the capital of the southern kingdom. And for those who feel secure on Mount Samaria, are you better than other kingdoms? Is your territory greater than their territory? Oh, you that put far away the evil day and bring near the reign of violence. Alas for those who lie on beds of ivory and lounge on their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the stall. I really like lamb chops. I don't mind a steak every now and then either, so I would have found Amos a bit of a problem. And if there was an Amos in my parish, I think I'd kind of slip out the back door. What I mean is we've all got, you know, we're not supposed to starve, but this is the except. If you've ever been in a country where there's terrific poverty and terrific riches right together, it is horrible. And isn't it sad that Australia is kind of heading in that direction a bit, like the gap between rich and poor is getting bigger, not smaller, when we've got this so-called tradition of mateship. So we've got to be careful. Those who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp. Come on, you lot. You should start blushing. And like David, improvise on instruments of music. Who drink wine from bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. They don't give a damn about the way the country's going downhill. Therefore, they shall now be the first to go into exile, and the revelry of the loungers shall pass away. You haven't had enough of Amos, I'll give you another one. Hear this, you that trample on the needy and bring to ruin the poor of the land, saying, when will the new moon be over so that we can sell grain? And the Sabbath so that we can offer wheat for sale. We'll make the ephah, that's a weight, small, and the shekel great. And practice deceit with false balances, buying the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, selling the sweepings of the wheat. Yahweh has sworn, surely I will never forget any of their deeds. And there's a lot of depth in that. I'm not here to talk about Amos, but see that bit about buying the needy for a pair of sandals? A subtle, but the sandals were being bought for a pilgrimage to the sanctuary. So, in other words, they're doing the religious things. They're going along to the sanctuary. They're going somewhere all very pious and fits in and no one could fault them. But the sandals that they've got are bought off the poor. So, I mean, we're all blushing a bit about this, I imagine. Because it's, you know, it's something we've got to be so sensitive to. And I don't know that any of us are that innocent. Look at this wonderful statement from Isaiah. Isaiah is a prophet in Jerusalem. And I put the Hebrew there for you, and the nearest I can put in English to the sound of it, because it's quite, he says, this is God speaking, or it's the prophet speaking, obviously, but inspired out of prayer. And he says, I, God, looked for justice, but behold a cover-up. I looked for righteousness, but behold a cry of distress. Now, listen to the Hebrew. I looked for mishpat, but I got mispach. I looked for tzedakah, but I got tzu'akah. You've got to listen carefully. They're almost the same word, just a slight little shift. Look at what the words look like. They read from right to left. See? Mishpat, mispach. There's one letter difference, and they're quite close. Look at the last two lines. Tzedakah, tzu'akah. So visually, auditory, they look the same. And this is actually a very key insight into the prophets, which we're not doing, but keep noticing the prophets actually do not speak out against injustice. They do, but they do something better than that. They speak about injustice that looks like justice, that's covered by the law, because the lawmakers are the rich and the powerful and the ones with power. So it's made to look all right. It appears okay. The political speech seems to cover it. The answers in Parliament never answer the question asked. They just keep drumming up the policy. So it's all, if you weren't a bit astute, you might think it's all, yeah, okay. But it's double talk, it's double speech, it's organising the law to suit the... that's what they're speaking out against. There's no genuine justice or righteousness. There's a cover-up or a cry of distress from the poor. Isaiah again. Ah, you who join house to house, who add field to field until there's room for no one but you. You're left to live alone in the midst of the land. Yahweh of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. You who rise early in the morning in pursuit of strong drink, who linger in the evening to be inflamed with wine, whose feasts consist of lyre and harp, tambourine and flute and wine, but have no regard for the deeds of Yahweh or see the work of his hands. And the text continues, therefore my people will go into exile without knowledge. Their nobles are dying of hunger. Their multitude is parched with thirst. People are bowed down. Everyone's brought low. And the eyes of the haughty are humbled. So that's enough on that. So I'm only making a point here. When we talk about stealing, we're not talking about someone in need who've been deprived of what they have by the rich, taking it, because it's actually theirs. It doesn't belong to me, living in my big mansion with everything I need and luxuries that I've got. We'll see a little bit more about that later. It actually belongs to the people, and if they take it, they're not stealing. I'm going to lock your doors after this talk. But is that okay? You get my point anyhow that they're trying to make here, that stealing is, that's not the commandment. It's not protecting luxury against unjustly acquired luxury against the needs of the poor. Okay, so Paul the VI in his encyclical Populorum Progressio in 1967 has this to say. Private property does not constitute for anyone an absolute and unconditional right. No one is justified in keeping for his exclusive use what he does not need when others lack necessities. John Paul II in Laborum Exercens, 1981, writes, Christian tradition has never upheld the right to private property as absolute and untouchable. On the contrary, it's always understood this right within the broader context of the right, common to all, to use the goods of the whole of creation. The right to private property is subordinate to the right to common use, to the fact that goods are meant for everyone. And again, a little bit later in 1991, in his another one of his many wonderful encyclicals on this matter, Centesimus Annus, 100 years since Leo XIII's inaugural encyclical, he writes, ownership of the means of production, whether in industry or agriculture, is just and legitimate if it serves useful work. It becomes illegitimate, however, when it is not utilized or when it serves to impede the work of others. In an effort to gain a profit which is not the result of the overall expansion of work and the wealth of society, but rather is the result of curbing them or of illicit exploitation, speculation, or the breaking of solidarity among working people. Ownership of this kind has no justification and represents an abuse in the sight of God and mankind. So we come now to the second section of the Catechism. Respect for goods, persons and their goods. And that's just a quick rundown of the kind of things that are covered in the Catechism, most of which I can't do now. Number 2408 of the Catechism says it's not theft to take another's goods in case of urgent necessity. You're there, you're actually starving, and you jump over the fence and take a few chooks out of my chook yard, or get some fruit off the tree, or grab some bread, or you go into my house and rob me to get something to feed your kids because they're starving and I'm not. So that's not theft. 2409, deliberately keeping what another has lent or lost. It talks about paying unjust wages, as against the seventh commandment. It talks about forcing up prices, doing poor work, getting paid but you're not doing the job properly. That's unjust too, obviously. Tax evasion, forgery, waste and excessive spending. 2410, these are just to cover the, look them up if you want to. 2410 talks about contracts. The next is on commutative justice, is justice in the area of exchange and transactions. It goes on to talk about obligation to make restitution. It talks about gambling. And it talks about slavery. And I just got a little note there. The Church's practice in this matter has changed. You'd think it would always have been clear, but it wasn't to some people. So there's been a development, thank God, in that area. The social doctrine of the Church, then, I recommend again this compendium of social doctrine of the Church to you. It's tough reading. We went through it in our parish with our social justice committee for a year, taking a chapter at a time, as well as doing other things, but just to enlighten us a bit. And most fairly hard going because it's pretty dry and academic, but it's a good doctrine, good statement of this. 2423 says the Church's social teaching proposes principles for reflection, just to get the mind in a good way, place to think. It provides criteria for judgment as to whether something's just or unjust, and it gives guidance for action. Obvious things, but if you're in any, this is, we all ought to be aware of this. 2423 says you cannot reduce a person to a means of profit. And 2425 is very critical of communism and of capitalism. So if you want to think about those issues, that number might guide you. The fourth section of the Catechism is on economic activity and social justice. And number 2426 reads, economic life is not meant solely to multiply goods produced and increase profit or power. Economic life is ordered first of all to the service of persons, of the whole human person and the entire human community. It's a beautiful statement. It's clearly true. I think it needs a lot of reflection by us, because you could get if you're looking at the newspaper and the amount of time given to it, and when you hear people talk even publicly, you could get the idea, you could forget the second, that it's actually about community, it's about people's wholesome lives that matters, it's about family, it's about children, it's about a beautiful environment for us. It's about all this kind of stuff. And the excesses of it are obvious, aren't they, when we I won't go into it now, I'm no expert in it, but when we actually are ruining our environment for a quick quid now, and our grandchildren may have nothing, there'll be no jungles even in Indonesia soon, or the Amazon will be depleted completely, or the ice from the ice caps, and all these are big issues, aren't they? And we've got to all be involved in doing our bit towards, because they matter, because economic activity is about ultimately happiness, a good life for the whole human community. 2427 talks about the importance and place of work, and all next week I'll be developing that with you for a whole lecture from the church's documents and so on. 2430, negotiation between different interests and groups. And then the next one is the state's responsibility in economic activity. Then it goes on to talk about employment, a just wage, and the place of strikes. And I'll pause again now, and then we'll take a break, and then I'll get into the rest of it for you.